Welcome, guys, to Behind the Shield. My name is James Gearing, and this is episode 30. And firstly, the fact that this is episode 30 blows me away. I've been told on several occasions that if you get six episodes out of a podcast, you can consider yourself established. Well, we just hit the 5x6 landmark, so I think we can say that we are very well established. And the list of people that I look at when I scroll down on our episode list so far is just, you know, humbling that these men and women are wanting to reach out to us. I'm sending out, you know, emails and texts, and these people are responding immediately, saying yes, they really want to reach out to the first responders of the world. We've had 25,000 downloads. We are listened to in 200 countries now. So I know that these great people are not only reaching the US, but they're reaching Europe and all the other continents out there. That really makes me feel good, because some of the countries that we now have people listening from may not have the resources, may not have these platforms for some of these incredible speakers to reach them. So I love the fact that podcasting is a medium that can literally transcend the globe, and all you need is an iPhone or a computer, and just find the podcast and hit play, and it doesn't matter whether you're in Antarctica or Bengal or Afghanistan, you can listen to this and improve your life the same way as we can here, you know, on the American platform. So that being said, my next guest is Mike Cleland. Now, Mike is a legend here in Central Florida. I've heard his name mentioned so many times. He started off in the city of Longwood as a firefighter and spent his whole career there, retired after 27 years as a battalion chief, and then went to law school and became an attorney. Now, Mike practices defending first responders in medical, I guess you could say, legal cases. So he specifically works with the heart and lung bill. He's a strong advocate for the cancer presumption law, which is ingrained in many, many states, but we talk about this is not in Florida. And then also PTSD, trying to get that as recognized as a workman's comp issue as well. So I sat in Morgan & Morgan. We did a face-to-face interview, and it was fantastic. I can't explain how much information is in this hour and a half. Mike also does presentations, goes around the country presenting the same kind of thing, and we get it for free. We get to listen and pick his brains, and you'll hear. He's just an absolute advocate for first responders, and he is our knight in shining armor when it comes to legal cases pertaining to illness and death in the first responder community. So I know you're going to enjoy this. I know that not only Mike's knowledge about the cases that we already know, but also he has an announcement on this show, a first-time announcement that I found extremely exciting as well. And I'm not going to say what it is. You can listen to the podcast. But that one thing that he's initiated is also going to change the lives of many, many first responders. So I can't explain how excited I was about this one. I mean, I'm excited about all of them. I haven't, you know, had a person yet that I'm even less than 110% excited about. And Mike is yet another mind that has put himself out there to benefit us. So before I say, without further ado, which is my little closer, don't forget to rate us on iTunes. Again, the more reviews we get on iTunes, the more visible we are. And then the more other men and women around the globe can become aware of this podcast. And then also share on Facebook, share on Instagram, share the podcast specifically. Find your favorite one, put a little post out about it, and let's get every single man and woman around the globe wearing a uniform listening to these incredible minds. So I will say it now. Without further ado, please enjoy Mike Cleland. Thank you. Welcome, guys, to Behind the Shield. I am sitting here today face-to-face with my guest, and it is attorney Mike Cleland. So how are you doing, Mike?
I'm great. Thanks.
Good. It always feels weird saying that, looking across the table from someone instead of over the phone.
That's quite all right.
All right. So
So you are a firefighter turned attorney. So so we can paint a picture of your journey. Where were you born and how were you raised?
Sure. I was born in Washington, D.C., lived there as an infant, and moved around the country a little bit as my family moved, and ended up in Central Florida. I think it was 1974. Went to elementary, middle, and high school here in Central Florida. And right out of high school, I went on to the fire department. My brother Steve, who just retired with 30 years at the City of Orlando Fire Department, sort of talked me into it. My goal ultimately was to play football in college, and had a real bad knee injury in my senior year of high school. But he talked me into coming over and giving the fire department a try after I graduated. And I did that, and I got on at the City of Longwood, which is up in Seminole County. And they hired me. I was a volunteer for about a year, and then I was hired soon after that in 1983, and then retired in 07.
Okay, so I guess the first question is, why didn't you get hired with the City of Orlando?
You know, everybody at the time was looking at Orlando as the, you know, preeminent department. And I don't know. I thought there were a lot of redeeming qualities about a small department. Our department was about 30 guys. And I felt comfortable there. So I didn't make the transition as about, I don't know, 10 of my buddies did ultimately.
And all right, so you just, right before we started recording, you mentioned that you actually were well involved in the fitness side of your department. So you were a football player, you were injured. What was your initial impression when you entered the fire service of the overall level of fitness back then?
Well, I think generally it was average at best. I mean, we had a lot of guys who were not necessarily obese, but were heavy guys. And strength, obviously, is a big component of firefighting. So I wasn't very critical of that. I just think the lax nature of shift work sort of breeds a lack of fitness. And so I got with the chief through the union. I was a union leader my whole career. And we sort of put together a sort of a makeshift fitness requirement that didn't have any discipline tied to it. But I attempted to motivate the guys and gals to be better fit. It went pretty well. I mean, there was some resistance, but generally speaking, it went pretty well. And so, you know, we got some equipment in the department, and we were able to go and play racquetball and run if we chose to run. And so just in sort of the overall theme of fitness began happening up there. And you know, I was proud of it. It certainly could have been better, but for the most part, it was favorable.
And so within the department, you rose through the ranks. What made you, at what point and what made you decide to start climbing the ladder after being in the firefighter position?
I was hired, like I said, in 83. I was promoted to engineer relatively quickly, which I thought was a real cool job. And then lieutenant, I think, in 87. And then battalion chief in 2002. I think my dates are right. But I wanted to rise to the ranks and not necessarily for the purpose of getting out of the union, but for the purpose of instilling the union values into management. Because when I was on the job, union and management were pretty diverse, not diverse, but divergent. Mm-hmm. We didn't share like views. I think that has changed now for the most part. But I wanted to be a part of that. My brother was a huge union advocate. So I don't know if I answered your question, but my goal was to become more educated, rise through the ranks, and then ultimately, when I retired, to do something else. Because, like I said, when I got in, I was only 17 years old. And when I retired, I was 44, 43, 44. And so I knew I wanted to do something else, which caused me to go and, you know, ultimately to practice law to represent first responders.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting because I'm sitting across the table from you at 43 years old. Only 13 years in, so I'm kind of the other side of the coin. But it is an interesting concept that guys that get into the job very early, obviously you guys, whether you like it or not, at a certain point where you're booted out, that must be a very strange experience regardless when that's been your family for that amount of time. But then to transition into a completely different profession, that must be strange as well.
It was. In my circumstance only, I just knew that after pulling a number of kids out of pools and cutting kids out of cars, that I didn't want to do more than 25 years. Ultimately, I did 26, but you get the point. I mean, those of us in this field see so much trauma on the EMS side and experience a lot of pretty scary situations on the fire and hazmat side that, I mean, I think for the average guy, of which I think I'm included, there comes a point at which you really should start thinking about getting out to avoid burnout. And so I think that's what happened to me. When I hit about 20 years, I knew I was going to do something and retire, but I didn't know what. But I knew I wanted to get out. There's just too much bad stuff.
Yeah, there's a great analogy that kind of popped in my head a while ago when I was doing the PTSD stuff, but I think it fits perfectly, which is the Green Mile, Michael Clark Duncan's character, where he's absorbing everyone else's illness, in our case, their trauma, and it does add up. And, you know, you can definitely shed some of it and being healthy and, you know, sleeping well and all these other things. But ultimately, I think, there's a point where enough is enough. And if we're fortunate, that point will be when we're ready to transition anyway. But I think, as we see in the field, sometimes that piles up so quickly that some of these men and women are caught, you know, caught by surprise.
No doubt about it. In fact, it's so interesting that the way I was thinking back in 2000, 2002 about the way I felt has come full circle now, because the people I represent either chose not to make a decision to get out or saw some things that were much more dire than I did, who are affected early on in their careers, and today I represent them, and that's the whole irony of this. I chose to get out to avoid situations where people are dying of heart attacks or have heart conditions that don't kill them right away, but they have serious heart conditions nevertheless, or they suffer PTSD, or they're just, you know, traumatized by the job. And so it was almost prophetic that I got out. But I see it every single day. I get calls, and I represent firefighters all over the state and police officers, by the way. Same sort of concept. You just are exposed over your careers to so much bad stuff that ultimately it'll take its toll. And now we're seeing, you know, increased incidence of cancer, which is a whole other issue.
Yeah. Yeah. We had Keith Tyson on the show a few weeks ago.
Yeah. Great guy.
Yeah. Again, that factors in. So we were talking before, we might as well jump into that now. The guys listening have probably seen me putting out some work now, really driving home what I think is the answer to specifically firefighter schedules, and this will transition to PD as well. But I have had so many people, Navy SEALs and doctors, and Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, who is the pinnacle in the armed forces as far as violence in society, and one of his big things is sleep deprivation. And they all concur when I ask them about the work week and the shift schedule, that first responders need to have enough time to recover from, you know, the shift, whether it's mental illness, whether it's physical illness. We, on paper, see about 100 line of duty deaths. And for decades now, you know, we've made our job safer, but yet it still seems to be a majority of illness. So I guess this is a multifaceted question. Firstly, that 100 line of duty, how does that compare to the people that actually walk through your doors? Is there a much greater hidden number? And then secondly, what do you think is causing such a huge number, if that is the case?
I think the number is much, much larger. Here's the problem. This awareness of these issues, sleep deprivation, trauma, psychosocial stress, these types of things, haven't been studied. In other words, there's no epidemiological data. Now, I'm not saying there's none, but there's not significant data because people haven't paid attention to it long enough to study it and write papers on it, epidemiological studies, which are the key source of our arguments, both with medical doctors in my litigation practice and with the legislature, which is where we need to change these laws to either make them part of the job or provide some sort of benefit or some sort of relief. You and I could say all day, because we've done this job, that it probably has some effect. And we can even point to anecdotal sources, firefighters themselves. And you can talk to doctors and have conversations with them, and they'll say, yeah, I'm sure there's some connection. What we have to have is studies. We have to have pen to paper, epidemiological data to support the argument. Because in my practice, when I litigate these issues and try to propose these things to doctors, off the record, they'll tell me, yeah, I'm sure it's a part of it, the sleep deprivation and other reasons for either heart disease or PTSD or sudden cardiac death and these types of things. They'll admit to you, but they can't point to anything. Now, NFPA has done some stuff, and I give a lot of credit to them. There was a study that came out, I think it was in 07, that was justified, and it was epidemiological in nature. There was a case study that said firefighters suffer more instant cardiac sudden death on fire grounds than don't. In other words, I mean, that doesn't make too much sense. But there was it was a significant study that says that most firefighters who have cardiac related illness die on the fire ground. So the point of the study was that on the fire grounds, when we have cardiac incidents, they result in death. Yeah, they don't survive. Right, exactly. But there are 35 states now, I think 36 perhaps, that presume heart disease is related to the job and are covered under workers' comp. In Florida, the reason for the so-called heart-lung presumption, it back 50 years ago, was what we call a public policy presumption. It was just that the legislature happened to give deference to firefighters because they suspected that because of what we're exposed to over our careers, that heart disease develops more. It was not based on any particular study, so it was a so-called public policy presumption. Right. We've not been able to add to that, and with support, with epidemiological data, to suggest, other than this NFPA study that I just referred to suggest that the development of heart disease over time is caused by either sleep deprivation or trauma or going from 0 to 100, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning when the klaxon goes off. There's not enough data to support that. There is some weak data on shift schedules and the development of heart disease and hypertension, but there's nothing really concrete yet. Now, I'm being long-winded. Does that mean that the legislature is going to take this presumption away from us? I don't think so. There's just too much support for first responders in Tallahassee to do that. Right. But I face every day in litigating these cases where defense lawyers and insurance companies and the League of Cities and the Association of Counties will say, you know what, you have no hard data to prove this. Well, we have the presumption, and that's all we need. The legislature said it's job-related. But I suspect that there'll come a day where there's going to be heavy scrutiny on actual data. But on the positive side, I think there's enough interest now, there's enough spotlight on this stuff, that there's going to be some studies, and I think it's going to prove prove the point that, in fact, everything that we're exposed to, in addition to sleep deprivation, in addition to psychosocial stress, that it is it has an increased effect on heart disease.
Yeah, I think that's something I'm seeing a lot as well when I delve down the wellness arena, is we've kind of been conditioned as a society to require data. But when we take a step back, there's data to prove that sugar doesn't cause diabetes. You know, there's data to prove that fast food won't make you fat. It depends on who's sponsoring that study and who they use, you know, and which parameters they use. And I think that's just it. If we can focus these studies to be a proper study and actually in include the correct parameters, and then show these people that are having to shell out the money by fixing these, you're actually going to reduce these claims instead of having to fight them all the time and spend all this money. To my very, very uneducated brain, that seems to make a lot of sense. We seem to be throwing so much money into requiring studies when the obvious is right in front of us. I mean, you look at a retiree, 2 years after they've left, they look 10 years younger, usually, as long as they're taking care of themselves. So, you know, you look at any firefighter or policeman that's been on a few shifts in a row. I mean, the special forces use sleep deprivation as you know, torture device, basically. So there's no question about the relevance of it. But it's like you said, it's right now we seem as a society to rely so much on prove it, even if it's staring you right in the face.
That's exactly right. And I think the best argument to make is in front of management. In other words, when you're at union negotiations, you're at the bargaining table and you're trying to argue for either increased fitness, either time or equipment or the ability or some other sort of fitness related proposal, your argument is better off made there than it is in the courtroom, for instance, unless we have data, because insurance companies, they want data. And thank God for the presumption. If we didn't have the presumption, then not only wouldn't I be in business, but firefighters all over the state wouldn't be given workers' comp benefits or pension benefits as a result of heart disease. So to your point about people wanting data, that's our best argument outside of a presumption scenario. But we have the presumption, and it's probably going to stay for a long time. I'm more concerned about the folks on the ground and why these things are happening at a breakneck pace. My business, unfortunately, has never been busier. I mean, just in the last 2 weeks, two deaths locally where widows or family of the deceased have called me for help. I can't tell you how many times we get guys in my office or word that these guys are in their 30s and 40s and die of massive heart attacks. There's just something going on aside from what I typically get as a defense, you know, social behaviors, diabetes and smoking and, you know, these other things that are in some ways preventable. There is something to be said for having to get up and go from zero at a dead sleep to, you know, pulling a kid from a pool or cutting someone out of a car or going into a house fire and trying to make a rescue. It certainly can't be good on the body. But having that data would be a lot more helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm hoping that we do get more and more, support on the study side. But I think as well as a profession, the more we start talking about this and being a root cause and fighting. I've spoken about this, the shift schedule I'm trying to push, which is the 24/72. And there's a whole bunch of raised eyebrows, eye rolls and, oh, good luck with that. That'll never work. I'm like, well, that's probably what they said about the SCBA and bunker gear, you know, and latex gloves and all these other things that we have now, because someone said, you know what, enough is enough. How many of us are going to die before we start saying, hey, why are we working 56 hours a week when the cashier in Publix is working 40? Anyone?
It's about changing the public's perception, because I wish you all the luck in the world and I applaud what you're doing. I really, really do. In the end, it boils down to money. And who's paying that money? Those are the taxpayers. And when the taxpayers are working two jobs to make ends meet and they look at us as sitting around the firehouse playing checkers, there's no way they're going to shell out a tax increase so that we can have 3 days off a week, 3 days at the end of a shift rather than two. Look, I did it, so I'm with you. And I represent guys who are sick, and so I'm with you. But convincing your next door neighbor of that, who think we already have it great and get a pension and get health insurance and these folks are struggling, that's who we have to convince. It's the folks that are, you know, paying the taxes, and that's the biggest battle. And again, it's all awareness. It all boils down to awareness and ultimately the money. I mean, because government will always fight you at the contract table for anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I agree. I agree 100%. And my town that I live in is in Marion County in Florida, yeah. And those guys get paid a pittance. And I know these people are so resistant to tax increases, and they're all driving Escalades and Winnebago's parked in their front lawn, and they're, you know, bitching, for lack of a better word, about, you know, a few dollars increase to support their teachers and their law enforcement and their firefighters. So I think culturally we are spoiled children and we need to be spanked and, you know, reset and realize what's important, because that Winnebago isn't going to save your child's life when the station that would be responding is browned out because you couldn't realize what the priorities really were in life.
Yeah, and that's the message, and reaching the folks with that message who matter is the key. And it's in mass. I mean, these folks are everywhere, and no one wants to pay more taxes, and the response to a proposal like that will probably be met with, well, do we want to raise taxes in order to do that? And so that's where the fight is. It's in the commission chambers. You know, it's a tough one. But look, you guys have done a fantastic job with raising awareness about cancer, about fitness. I mean, I've never in my life seen so much focus on fitness in the fire service, thanks to guys like you. I mean that. And so this issue about changing the work schedule can be done. It's just going to take a hell of a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're going to have to be bloody minded and stubborn. So
yeah.
I'm
yeah,
certainly
yeah,
going to
yeah.
jump on that bandwagon.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's steer it back to, you know, to the fact that you do spend your career, you know, helping our brothers and sisters and where they're at right now. And obviously prevention, you know, kind of like our job, you know, that sadly when they see you, it's reactive. It's not proactive. So I just kind of want to wind in again. So at the end of your career, you also went into politics. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did. Okay. I'm a political junkie. Okay. I love politics. And so that's where I wanted to go with my undergrad. And then after that, I said, you know what? I mean, you know, you did it. You love the guys. You love the camaraderie about the job. So I wanted to stay connected. The question was how I would do that. And a guy named Rich Sawicka, who's a union side labor attorney here locally, everyone who listens to this in Central Florida will know Rich. He sort of prompted me to go that route. And then when I did that, I went to law school when Florida A&M University got resurrected here in Orlando. There was a fight at the time between Tampa and Orlando who would get the bid. Orlando got the bid, and I just finished up out at UCF. So I put my application in, took my LSAT, put my app in, and they accepted me, luckily, in a night program. So I was actually finishing up my career at the fire department and going to school at night to get my law degree. And then once I did, I had a choice to either do union side labor, the traditional grievance arbitration route, or look into this so-called heart-lung presumption, this act under 112.18 of the Florida statutes. And it just intrigued the hell out of me. And so I delved into it and went in headlong, and, you know, here we are today. And so I stay connected. I stay connected with firefighters and cops just on this level. And it's been a lot of fun. It's hard work, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Do you plan to pursue politics further? We'll come back to the law side.
I completely rebuffed your question.
That's
no,
fine.
I did. I went into politics. I ran for the state house and was elected up in Seminole County in 2012 and served in the Florida House for a few years. And then it's a very, very conservative area town, and I got beat upon reelection, which is okay. That's fine. Look, I'm a Democrat, lifelong Democrat, but I'm a very moderate guy. I don't know if you want to get into politics, but it seems like people are just polarized. You know, the Republicans are extreme, the Democrats are extreme, and I'm sort of this disappearing middle of Florida politics. And so it didn't work. And so that's fine. I love politics. I want to stay involved and stay connected. I ran for the state Senate here. I moved to Winter Park to be closer to my office downtown, and people were knocking on the door saying, hey, you got to give this open Senate seat a shot. And so I did. And it turns out that I was defeated, but I was defeated by someone on the far left. So, you know, up in Seminole County where I lived, it was a really very, very, very conservative area town. And then when I moved to Winter Park to be closer to work, I gave it a shot, and I was defeated by someone who's just way too left for me. But it's a very liberal area, so I can't seem to find my niche. But I'm very, very happy in my practice, and I love doing what I'm doing, notwithstanding the political issue.
Right. Well, actually, you kind of illustrate how the kind of same thing that I've learned the last, what has it been, a year or so. I finally became a citizen, finally got to vote.
Oh, very good,
and
man.
This,
that's
this
awesome.
Was the first election. And when I saw it unfold, it kind of reminded me, you know, even though, of course, everyone's vote counts, the pyramid is, you know, upside down the way we look at it. You know, we think that the person at the very tip of the pyramid is who's controlling this country. And everyone forgets that the base is us. People like yourself and me and everyone else. And yeah, you can have a favorite pony in the race, I guess you could say. But ultimately, if you're not stepping out your front door and helping the people immediately in your community, you're not going to change this country. And whatever side you hope to win, or if within your department you think that someone got screwed over, if you go out there and you make a difference, then we can change the country, you know, with our choices, with our kindness, and with our dollars as well. I mean, I'm seeing it even in my local community with healthy eating. You know, the crappy restaurants are starting to close down and the organic grocery stores are starting to open up, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, amen to that. And I, you know, this democratic way of life in this country is not perfect, but this sort of tip of the pyramid, as you referred to it, there are lots of checks on the system for things like that happening, that one person can so-called rule the country. I mean, you have Congress and you have the court. So, you know, times are very different now since the election, and but there are enough checks on the system that I have full faith that everything is going to be fine. I mean, people are screaming about Donald Trump, and others like him, and they're very conservative folks who like him and say give him a chance. I'm sort of somewhere in the middle, and I think it's all going to work itself out.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's the bottom line that I've seen in everything in life. You know, you have the extreme left and right, and if you kind of aim halfway, you're probably going to be in a good place. So
yeah, I hope so. It's just ironic that there aren't enough. Well, I say enough. There aren't enough, I guess, in my mind, moderate, just sensible people that just understand the politics of the right and understand the politics of the left, and we can come to some agreement. If everyone would just give a little bit, we could advance good policy and be, I don't know, in my mind, happier. Maybe I'm just being Pollyanna, but I found when I was in Tallahassee that, you know, when I was up there in 2012, I knew nationally that we were polarized because that's just the way things have been for the last 20 years or so. But when I got to Tallahassee, it was just no different. It's the same sort of ideas. And I think they're extreme on both sides. I mean, I pissed off my caucus many, many times, but I did it because it's the right thing. You know, you can't be so left that you're crazy. And the same with the right. It's just, there aren't enough people with my mindset, unfortunately. And hell, I'm 53 now. I don't know how much more time I have in politics, but anyway, it's a shame there aren't more people who have more moderate views about the way things should be.
Yeah, I think we also get a very bizarre snapshot of these views with, if you can call it media, the so-called news that we have here, and I don't mean that left or right. Just we have a sensationalist news system here. And then obviously the social media side as well. But I think, I wonder if there are more people that are in that central block, but we just get exposed to the extreme left. Because, I mean, I come from the NHS in England as a healthcare system. I loved it. And I watched my 99-year-old grandfather be treated better in his last few days with cancer than I did anyone over here in this country that would have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on the same care. But I also completely disagree with people sponging from the system, you know, so there's that middle ground there. But sadly, if it's one or the other, everyone misses out on the middle ground, which would be you wouldn't have to be standing greeting people at Walmart at 80 years old just to pay your health insurance.
Yeah, we think alike. Yeah, that's a very, very good point. But you're right. It highlights where we are. And is it a result of, you know, the 24-hour news cycle and the sort of extremes on each side? Probably. I mean, we tend to latch on to one or the other. And I don't know, I wish people would just have more independent thought than sort of latching on to a particular side. You know, take it all in and then form your own thought. You know, where's the BS on this side and where's the BS on that side? And call them out and let's try to make some headway. Mm-hmm. But I hope the ship rights itself, because we're so polarized and it's sad. You know what I mean? It, to me, it's really sad.
Yeah. Yeah. I have full faith in a paradigm shift right now. I think, you know, you're seeing it with nutrition. You're seeing it with, I don't even like to use the word fitness movement. I mean, 15 years ago, there were no mud runs. There was no CrossFit. And these, I'm just using popular names, but to get housewives that have been struggling with their weight running through military style obstacle courses is fantastic. Yeah. To get people eating food from the ground like their grandparents ate without calling themselves hippies is fantastic, you know. So we've made such a shift, but again, there's extremes on both sides. You can be a raw vegan and, you know, only eat from the hills of the Himalayas, you know, or you can set up campus in McDonald's and only eat fast food your entire life. Yeah. Same as every other issue. There's a left and a right, and the middle ground is always, you know, going to be kind of where you're at. So
yeah,
I have faith that the ship is turning, but
I do too.
You know, it's an interesting
story.
It's
a slog. It's a long slog.
All right. Well, we've talked about the heart and lung, though. So which, I saw one of your videos you did for, I don't even know which department it was, but someone had filmed the whole presentation that you'd done. So can you tell us about the heart and lung bill, and then who is eligible for that? And then I know there's a very key point about recruitment physicals and how that affects everything as well.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. What I do is I travel the state and I teach this presumption law. And I do it not to toot my horn, but I do it because insurance companies and employers don't teach firefighters and police officers and corrections officers this law. So they don't know what gives rise to a claim. They don't know when they have a claim. They don't know what's covered. And so I teach them. In fact, one of the things that really caused me a lot of heartburn was when I learned that in your area, one of the departments up there, about 10 or 15 years ago, an adjuster convened all three shifts of this fire department in an airplane hangar and told them that this law didn't exist anymore. And so that struck me so hard that I sort of became like on a mission, and I wanted to get around and teach this stuff. And so as a backdrop, that's what I do. Aside from litigating these things, that's what I do. I teach first responders this law. And so basically, in a nutshell, the law was created about 50 years ago when the legislature decided to give firefighters deference for heart disease and hypertension. Now, tuberculosis is also part of the covered conditions that the presumption covers, but it's rarely ever an issue. I mean, fire departments treat TB all the time, and it's not something that's ongoing. So we rarely see a case of tuberculosis, but in terms of heart disease and hypertension, in firefighters and now in law enforcement officers and corrections officers, they're covered assuming a few prerequisites are met. And those prerequisites are, A, that you're a member of the covered class, firefighter, cop, corrections officer. Two, that you have a covered condition, any one of many forms of heart disease or hypertension. So that's the covered condition. The third prerequisite that we must come to the table with is that we have a pre-employment physical with the agency. So if you're with Reedy Creek and you were hired in 2000 and Reedy Creek put you through some sort of physical, the statute doesn't talk about how extensive the physical has to be, but that they put you through some sort of medical screening before you were hired. And if that pre-employment physical, as it's been loosely dubbed, fails to reveal the evidence, any evidence of the condition you're claiming, let's say it's heart disease, if the pre-employment physical is void of any, you know, heart disease, ectopy on an EKG, or something that says, oh, he's got pre-existing coronary artery disease. And 99.9% of them don't, by the way. So if the pre-employment physical is clean, then that you've met the third prong. The last prong and the situation that gives rise to a claim or allows you to avail yourself of this presumption is that you suffered some disablement. Disablement is not that you have to have been bedridden by this condition. It just means that you had to, a doctor had to have said to you, stay out of work. And it, now, I don't want your listeners to think that a doctor has to actually tell you that. What it means is that you were temporarily incapacitated from performing your full duty firefighter functions. So if, I'll give you two extremes. One, you go to a doctor on your off duty and he says, oh, you have hypertension, here's a medication, and you know, don't go back on the truck until it comes down a little bit. Even if it's one of your days off, that's sufficient. The other alternative or the other extreme of this example of disability is that you're on a cath table and you're getting a stent or a bypass. You're physically incapable of performing, you know, getting on a truck or performing duties while you're laying down with a catheter in your heart. So those are the two extremes. The key is that you had to have been incapacitated. Now, a lot of people think, well, gee, I was on duty when this happened. I went into a training exercise and they took my blood pressure and it was too high. Where you are when this happens is immaterial. You could be on a cruise ship or you could be in Vail skiing with your family and have some sort of disablement. That gives rise to a claim.
Okay, so there's a big misunderstanding that it has to happen on shift. Obviously, there's a blurring with the line of duty side where they think 24 hours within the shift.
Yeah, they used to defend these claims and say, well, gee, you didn't miss any time from work. In other words, this event happened when you were off duty. And the key, I'll spend just a minute explaining in more detail so that your listeners can understand this. The seminal case on disability came out of Sarasota. It was a cop, and he had an arrhythmia, some sort of palpitations or something. They took him to the hospital. It was a Friday afternoon, and he went into the hospital, and they started an IV, and they bolused him with some medication, and it calmed down his arrhythmia. He was there for mere hours. He was already off duty, and then the doctor said when he got out of the hospital, you can go back to work Monday. So he was off Saturday and Sunday, went back to work Monday, full duty police work. Well, the claim was filed. They defended it on the grounds that he didn't miss any work. He didn't have any lost wages. And it went up to the First District Court of Appeal, who interpreted the statute and said, look, this isn't about wage loss. It doesn't matter that he wasn't on duty. This is about, for that short period of time that he was in the hospital getting medicated for this arrhythmia, that triggered disability. So it had nothing to do with whether he was in his patrol car or whether he went back to work that following Monday. It was that period of time that gave rise to the claim. So the key for your listeners is to know that doesn't mean that a doctor has to say, hey, Joe, stay out of work. Here's a medication. Go away. Or it doesn't also have to mean that he or she was in the hospital getting a heart cath. Now, that could be the triggering event, but it doesn't have to be so extreme. So the key is, if you have any question about this, please call me. I'll walk you through it. I'll just walk you through it over the phone to tell you whether or not you've met the prerequisites for the presumption.
Okay, brilliant. And then I remember as well, you had two time periods. I know one was medical and one was like a traumatic injury. So 30 and 90 days.
Oh, okay. So now we're talking about notice. And again, if you need a class or your local needs a class on this, I'm happy to come. No charge. I'll just come and give it to you. But it's a much more extensive. It's a two-hour class where I explain these details. But what you're talking about is notice. When you have a workers' comp case in Florida, you have 30 days to notify the employer. And that clock begins to run at the point at which you knew or should have known it was work-related. Okay? Now, that's an injury by accident claim. And I'll explain what that means. If you're on a roof cutting a hole and you fall through and break your leg, that means you're on shift, you fell through, you broke your leg. Who's going to deny that claim, right? You're on duty. That's an injury by accident. It's an accident that happened at work. These cases, these heart disease and hypertension cases, are what we call occupational disease. They happen over time, okay? In occupational disease cases, you notify the employer 90 days, not 30. You get 90 days to notify the employer of the triggering event, which was this disability that I just spoke about. Now, for folks who don't know anything about the heart bill, these guys can go years and years and years and never notify the employer because they didn't know about the heart-lung bill. So remember what I said in the beginning. The clock begins to run at the point at which you knew or should have known it was work-related. So if you didn't know that you had a heart claim, I get calls even today where firefighters will call me and say, God, I got a stent put in back in 2002 or 2001. I mean, here we are 15 years later. And I say, well, what did the department do? Well, I don't know. I don't know what the heart lung covers. I thought it was only heart attacks. So people have this mixed message, if any message at all, about what kind of claim they have, when they have it, and what they should do. And that's why I walk around. That's why I travel the state and I teach this law. Because the insurance companies and the employers are not going to tell you. Why? Because they're expensive claims. They provide a vast array of benefits, and they don't want these firefighters to know. Period. That's what it's about.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. The whole reason for me doing this project is to try and minimize that happening. However, obviously, it is going to happen, and you know, it happened to one of my brother firefighters very recently, and we lost him, so he wasn't. Going down the initial workman's comp area. But again, this is a perfect example of where, in my opinion, the career as a firefighter ended up, you know, taking his life. So I'm hoping that will result in that being viewed completely related to the job that he was in.
Yeah, death cases provide death benefits to a spouse and or children. And in your example, assuming the death was caused by a heart attack, then arguably his widow would have death benefits coming. Now, these are particularly sensitive for obvious reasons, but insurance companies will deny these cases in any case. Why? Because the firefighter or police officer, corrections officer, is not here to tell anything about it. They certainly are, you know, they're dead. They don't know about it. And it's even less likely that a spouse would know about this stuff. And so the workers' comp insurance company will probably deny that case and others like it. And so when I teach this law, I explain the circumstances under which death benefits are owed.
Okay. And are you able to just kind of highlight those? I mean, I'm sure this is sure. Trying to cram your whole 2-hour
no,
course into this interview.
I'm happy to. The death benefits are $150,000 to a spouse and or children. And it's pretty convoluted in the statute because it breaks it down whether they're age of majority or minority, whether they're in school. But the point is, if someone's married who passes away of heart disease or a heart attack or something related to blood pressure, then death benefits are due and owing to the spouse and or children, depending on the situation. The same argument is made. And if that firefighter or police officer had a physical upon entering into service with this agency, then that's a claim. That person can avail him or herself of the presumption or the widow. Now, there's no argument about disability, right? I mean, there's no more disability than death. And so there's not going to be a defense in that case on that issue. Now, what I failed to tell your listeners is that it's only a presumption. It's not an absolute. And they get to deny these claims because the burden shifts from the employee to the employer to prove some other cause of this heart disease or hypertension. They can't throw risk factors at it, although they do every day as a basis for their denial. But their job is to prove some other non-industrial cause of the heart disease or hypertension. And it's virtually impossible for them to do that. And so that's why I take these cases, because I'm defending against the employer insurance company's ability to rebut or overcome the presumption. And so that's in a nutshell how this works. Again, it's about an hour and a half lecture so that I can get into the details and the nuts and bolts for those who are interested in having a class.
All right. And then another question then, how does what you deal with and our laws that are kind of protecting us now compare to the veteran benefits when they leave the armed services?
I'm not a veterans benefits guy. We do have folks here who handle VA benefits. I don't want to speak out of turn and mislead your listeners.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay, so we talked about the heart and lung bill. Where are we at with cancer presumption in this state?
That's a great question. For years, we've tried in Tallahassee to get something through, to punch something through. And as a basis, at least in part, a basis for the argument is that 34, 35 other states in the country recognize as a presumption some sorts of cancers. You know, and it varies state by state. Workers' comp benefits are creatures of state, so every state has to have their own benefit unless the federal government decided one day to sort of put a heavy hand on it and for all firefighters deem certain types of cancers compensable under workers' comp. But I find that would be a very, very difficult struggle as a sort of preemptive measure. Having said that, we have a very, very conservative legislature, overwhelmingly conservative in the House and the Senate. And our governor is a Republican and otherwise very conservative. That's not to say that that's the reason we haven't punched anything through, but the overwhelming majority of Republicans in the House and in the Senate and in the governor's mansion are very, very skeptical of things like this. And so it's tough to get something through. This year, this last session was as close as we've come. And it didn't make it, unfortunately, but that's not to say we won't try next year. The epidemiological data in support of this, which, by the way, is what they want, and I'll circle back to the very beginning of this podcast, that's what we got to have as our biggest muscle, our biggest argument. And that is becoming more available as these studies start coming out. So sort of in a long-winded way of answering your question, we're getting closer every day. But I suspect that it'll be a few years before we get something concrete.
Right. So I think that illustrates exactly what I was talking about when we were talking about research before. It's common knowledge that first responders die about 12 years earlier than our, you know, civilian counterparts. And, you know, the likelihood of getting certain cancers are up to more than double. So, you know, again, it's out there, but it's sad that these decisions are made by men and women that sit at a desk for 40 hours a week and then go to their nice home with their, you know, creature comforts. And yet the people that are out there putting their lives on the line, you know, and are dying and have a, you know, this trail of fallen firefighters and law enforcement and EMS personnel. And we still have to fight so hard, even though everything's there in front of them.
It is a shame. And to the point that everything's there in front of them, I had a case locally that I took in front of a pension board. It was a cancer case without a presumption. And it was a slog. And as part of my evidence, I took the deposition of an epidemiological doctor who sat on the 9/11 commission, and she's brilliant. And I took her depo and I had her cite to several studies in support of our position. Surprisingly, there are a number of studies that say that that's not the case. And so that's the struggle. Just when you think that you've got absolute and concrete data, if you're fighting an insurance company, they're going to find data that suggests that there's an argument the other way.
Did you say find or fund?
Find. Well, look, that was no Freudian slip. It's probably a little bit of both. There, you know, the powers that be can find doctors to make an argument that if we say one study without question supports our claim in any particular type of cancer, there will be another study out there to refute it in some way. And so the question becomes, whose argument is stronger? So the more data that we have, and the more recent data, by the way, that we have, and I think we're getting that. In fact, the legislature approved almost $1 million. You probably talked to Keith about this, the University of Miami, to study Florida firefighters about any increased rates of cancer versus the general population. I applaud Keith and those guys so much. They're tireless. They've worked on this forever. But my question has always been, why in the hell would anyone want to study Florida firefighters versus, I don't know, a Georgia firefighter versus an Illinois firefighter? We're all we face the same sort of byproducts of combustion and a structural fire than anyone else. I mean, we have old buildings that have asbestos, that so do they do in New York and Philly and Chicago. Why would Florida firefighters face any less risk of any particular type of cancer than one in any other state? That's always been a question of mine, rhetorical, obviously, but I still wonder about that. I was thrilled to death that they got $1 million to go down there and do some work. Anything can help, especially in this legislature. But I always wondered about that. Like, why would our guys and gals face any different statistical variation of particular types of cancers or the rate at which we get cancer? I don't get it.
Yeah.
Maybe you know.
Well, I don't. Yeah. You said that there was about 30 states that have this presumption already?
I think we're upwards of 35, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So we're talking three-quarters
some
of the
variation,
the country.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I think that, again, is a statistic. If three-quarters of the country has said, yes, this is real, and like,
dude,
you said,
I'm
we're all
you.
Doing the same job.
I'm with you. And I think Keith and those guys and the International, who I applaud, their health and safety division, are probably working together to find out not only how they got the legislatures in different states to enact the legislation and ultimately have it in law, but also rely on the data that they supplied to get it put into law. And so I trust Keith and those guys are doing all of that. So I'm not an expert. I just have had some small part in helping with the FPF and their initiative to get something through the through our legislature, and ultimately we haven't been successful.
I've lost worked in the East Coast and the West Coast, and I've lost 7 firefighters I work with personally to cancer, all of them, you know, around my age or younger. And we had Carl Andriano here in town who passed away a few years ago, who was in early 20s. So, but he'd been a fireman in a very busy house for a few years. It's another thing that we as a brother and sisterhood, I think, need to start banging on the walls and making more noise until this becomes a norm.
Yeah. Interestingly, though, in terms of getting something through the legislature, you know, the outcry among our own firefighters, it's never been stronger. But for those that you see on social media all the time, and for those who speak the loudest and beat the drum, we have to acknowledge and understand that getting legislation passed is as much about relationships with people than it is about beating a very loud drum. And I know that because I was in Tallahassee, and I know the way legislation gets through. You've got to form good relationships and know the right people and make the deals behind the scenes. It's not a shady thing. It's just knowing. It's being able to lobby your position through the right people without looking too belligerent, without being too, I don't even know what the right adjective is, but you have to know the right people and do the right, make the right connections and get it passed that way. You've got to convince people before session starts, instead of getting a legislator to draft a big, heavy piece of cancer legislation and trying to get it assigned to committee. Because the people who assign it to committee and the committee heads themselves, they already know what's going on. They're either going to get it and hear it, or get it and hear it and kill it. So it's about relationships more than it is this sort of groundswell of support.
Right. Yeah, I've seen that personally, even in my department, how there was a lot of banging of heads of you know, sides.
Yeah.
And it seemed just that when they were able to kind of de-escalate a little bit and just start talking again, it appeared from my lowly angle that things started to finally, you know, move forward. So I can totally see that from a small scale point.
Yeah, the louder the drum is not sort of, it doesn't mean that that's, you stand that much a better chance of getting something through. It's about relationships and behind the scenes and who you have lined up and who's willing to listen. Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's one more area that's come up, and I'm pretty sure it's crossed your desk as well. The PTSD side in workman's comp. I mean, when I started doing the Dark Side project, and I've talked about this in other podcasts, I had some friends from departments reach out to me that, and I always say that the alpha male, but they were the one in the room you think would be least affected, you know, physically looking at them. And it's a real thing. And from my perspective, I think these men and women, when they hit that wall, whatever happened prior, they need time to heal the same way as you would from a back injury. Now, I've said this a million times. I'm not talking about throwing a pity party and being disabled the rest of your life and, you know, just whimpering in a corner. Like a back injury, the goal is to get you back to work. You know, I mean, there's nothing great about limping from the parking lot, you know, in your disabled space and you're not enjoying life the rest of your life. But I think we also have a responsibility to understand that there is this post-traumatic stress and it can disable you for a time, whether it's, you know, long term or hopefully just short term, then it becomes post-traumatic growth. What are the kind of angles on the PTSD and the things that these men and women see within the legal side?
A few things. Number one, it's very real. Very real. I represent a lot of folks with it. In Florida, PTSD is what they consider a nervous injury. And so it only provides medical treatment and not wage loss benefit under workers' comp, unless the PTSD stems from a physical injury. And let me give you an example of what that might be, but in a vast majority of the cases, it is not. if you're rolling out to an alarm and you're going through an intersection and you get T-boned by a Pepsi truck, and as a result of that, you're laid up in the hospital with multiple broken bones, broken neck, and from that event, you are diagnosed with PTSD. In that case, will you get the wage loss benefit that is otherwise provided under work comp. A vast majority of PTSD cases, if not, well, a vast majority is the perfect way to put it. PTSD results from something that's not associated with a physical injury. It is strictly a result of what we see over time. It might even be stemmed from an acute thing, like on one particular call you just witness so much you can't handle it. But most of the time it involves folks who over time have been exposed to so much bad stuff that it has taken its toll. And in those cases, work comp will get involved and assign you a workers' comp psychologist or psychiatrist, but no wage loss benefit, despite the fact that that doctor says you don't need to be back on the job for a long time. Right. Which does two things. Number one, it doesn't provide a wage loss benefit, so now the firefighters without wages, a lot of these guys and gals burn up their accrued leave. So now they have no wage loss. Now they're forcing themselves to convince the doctor to get back on the job that they really shouldn't be on because they suffer from PTSD. Yeah. We were so, so close. In fact, it came down to the last day of session, this session, of getting a bill through that took away the physical injury component for first responders. In other words, wage loss would be provided like it is in any other injury for folks with PTSD. And it didn't make it. It got traded at the very end for something else. God only knows what. And we lost again. But it is a very, very important issue. And we're extremely close to getting something through for first responders that doesn't have this ridiculous physical injury requirement in order to get wage loss benefits. And that's what the guys need.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we're seeing so many suicides in law enforcement, in EMS, in fire, and these aren't you know, even I don't know, like spiraling down. These are incredible events. Like one of my brothers out on the West Coast leapt from a freeway bridge. We had a female firefighter leap from a moving car. I mean, this is not even sane thinking of making a decision to finally end.
They're
it.
Out this of control. Is, yeah. It's related to the job. Doctors will tell you that it's related to the job. And in Florida, they just don't provide a wage loss benefit, which, by the way, is what they need so that they can get well and get back to work. The whole spirit of the Work Comp Act is to get people back to work. Yeah. And so that's the irony. And I'll tell you, and I'll give deference to the legislature, I don't think it was about the fight to get these benefits through. This was about getting a good bill in at the very end, and it just got traded for something that was much more important up there. It was less about the fight against first responders in this wage loss. In fact, a very conservative Senator Perry up in your neck of the woods, Ocala, Gainesville area, it was his bill. And I read it, and I championed it with the FPF. People were very skeptical because they read it in such a way that they thought maybe it doesn't provide what we want. And the FPF deferred to me a little bit on it, and it was a great bill. And the House companion was very, very good too. And so in the end, we were just keeping our fingers crossed that it would make it through and be signed by the governor. And something happened where it just got traded out.
Such a shame.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really bad stuff.
Yeah. I mean, because like you said, the two angles that I look at it from, the prevention, obviously the sleep deprivation, the shift schedules, all those things. There's no question. I've had people back me up on this as well. You know, the sleep deprivation affects mental health, period. So there's that. But then on the other side, like you said, if we're trying to reduce workman's comp and keep people in their job, and if they do get hurt mentally, physically, then return them to the job, I'm an absolute proponent in that too. But they're cutting off their nose to spite their face when they're blocking these people that are hurting mentally or physically from, you know, getting back to work. And I have the same issue with workman's comp physical injuries. I myself hurt my back and I was sent to a local urgent care, and had a bunch of medication thrown at me. I'm like, do you not even understand anatomy and physiology? I've torn ligaments in my back. That's not going to help. I need physical therapy and, you know, time to heal. And that's exactly what I did. And I was lucky enough to be kind of aggressive and championing my own care. But again, that wasn't in the best interest. It probably would have resulted in surgery and then made me a less efficient member of the workforce. So it's so weird how they're creating a much worse employee by putting these in, and you know, and they could be actually investing a little money up front and having a much greater savings in the long run.
Yeah, no doubt. I've got something that I wanted to say regarding an initiative that I hope will make it out here in the next few months. If you'll just give me 2 minutes.
Oh, you got as long as you want.
The heart disease issue has been so prominent lately, with guys and gals dying of heart attacks and suffering from heart disease cases. I and a friend of mine who's a doctor up in Seminole County have looked at about 130 guys up in Seminole County who underwent what we call a calcium score. Calcium score is a non-invasive CT scan of the coronary arteries, and it measures the likelihood of plaque buildup in your coronary arteries. Okay. It is a very quick scan, takes about 15 minutes max, and it's indicative of coronary artery disease. So about 10 years ago, about 130 guys up in Seminole County went through this calcium score. It turns out that 10% of them ended up with invasive procedures as a result of this, either getting stents or bypass. Wow. So think about that. These folks are walking around asymptomatic with little to no risk factors, who ended up with life-saving invasive procedures as a result of this calcium score. Okay? Yeah. So calcium score scans are considered elective under group health insurance. So you're not going to be able to go through and get a calcium score and have your insurance company pick it up. They just consider it elective. So I thought to myself, if we could convince big major hospital chains to get on board with this initiative and offer calcium scores free of charge. If you consider there's roughly 35,000 firefighters in the state and probably 2.5 times as many police officers. If we got them in the door and the hospital chains agreed to offer these calcium scores, and 10% of whatever number you're looking at, you're going to save their lives without question, assuming the Seminole County model holds. And I don't know why it wouldn't. This is a random group of guys and gals. 10% of them had major, major invasive procedures done, which absolutely saved their lives, no question about it. If we do this on a grand scale, have the hospitals fund it, think about the result. We'll be saving hundreds, if not thousands, of lives because these people are walking around needing invasive procedures right now, and they don't even know it. The key is to get them in the door, get them scanned, and then get them treatment. But they won't go to the hospital chain themselves because they're not going to pay for it, and their insurance company is not going to pay for it. So I have met with corporate people in both Florida Hospital and Orlando Health, and both of them are on board. Oh, fantastic. And it gives me chills to talk about it. And so in the next few weeks, we are trying to work out the logistics of who can go where, who's going to pay what, how they're going to fund the projects, get cardiologists who will read the scans, and get these folks in the door and get them scanned. And I could not be more thrilled with this project that we hope will come to fruition in the next month or so. And so I'm thrilled that this can happen. For the folks who are listening in your podcast earshot, I would like people to start talking about how many people in their department or their local, if they're talking about unions, would go in and go through a very non-invasive 15-minute CT of the heart, which gives them a number, and from that number it'll determine whether or not you need to be in a cath lab, who'd be willing to do it and to notify me. Because what we're doing now with these hospital changes, trying to get some data about how many folks we can get in, how quickly it would be, so that we can brace for it and have the right facilities available. And so this is the first time I've mentioned this publicly, but I'm teaching at the FPF next week. I'll be revealing it down there, and then I have the FOP conference here following, and I'm also going down for the safety stand down in Miami. So this is something I could not be happier about. And I just finished meeting with Orlando Health 2 weeks ago, and their folks are very encouraged and happy to be getting on board. So we hope to be sharing something very, very good here in the near future.
Well, that's fantastic, because I think one of the biggest criticisms of, you know, what insurance does cover is it's all reactive again. You know, you try and go to a chiropractor or sports massage or any of a nutritionist, and you're going to be up against it. Maybe you might get 5 sessions covered in a year. So for them to, I know it's not the insurance company, for the health industry to get behind an initiative like that, I think is phenomenal.
It was an undertaking to get in the door, but I did, these folks just thought, you know what, as a public policy matter, it just makes so much sense. These are relatively very inexpensive scans. I think they're $125 for the guys up in Seminole County. And imagine the cost of about maybe 2/3 less for the hospitals themselves. And they have grant money and they have other ways of funding these projects. And can you imagine even a very conservative number? Let's say we got 10,000 firefighters in to have these scans. That's 1,000 guys and gals who have life-saving procedures. I mean, it's amazing to me as I sort of spun this out. And I was so happy that these hospital chains would be on board to do this. And so the details of all this will be coming out soon.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we could break the news here.
Yeah.
Have to, I got one to publish this week, but I'll put this air this next week so we can get it out there as soon as possible. Great. So fantastic. All right. So I'm just trying to see what else. Okay. So we've had your time for over an hour now. There is one more thing I wanted to talk about. There's two things I want to talk about. Firstly, kind of adding to that as well, so the physical health of first responders, something literally went across my desk this morning, and it's another area that people don't talk about, assault of first responders. So we've had a lot of incidents everywhere from that poor FDNY medic being run over when the guy stole her rescue. I myself have been... I haven't been assaulted because I exercise and I do martial arts and, you know, have been able with my fellow firefighters to restrain said attacker. But, could have been a different story. And then we get a lot of, obviously, scenarios, especially in law enforcement, where people are. Do you have any of those cases come across your desk at all?
Luckily, I don't.
Okay.
I don't. In fact, since I've been practicing, I don't know that I've had any. That's ironic too, because when I was on the job, every now and then you get a patient who either just is crazy or high or something that you know, they'll throw a punch or kick you or try to stick you, or, you know what I mean? But I've not had any cases where, that has happened that people needed my help. It might be that it would be very difficult for an insurance company to deny a case like that. I get cases when they're denied. You know, I get cases when people need help because the insurance companies are just giving them fits. It might be that if you had a claim because you were injured on the job as a result of that, that the insurance company would just feel silly to deny treatment and benefits.
Because I know one of the points that this video was trying to make was that a lot of times we don't report it. And I know as a medic, you know, and an EMT, we're kind of taught like, oh, don't be too rough with the patient, you know, be careful. And then you get like the guys in California that get stabbed and, you know, these guys get off the fire engine and they get shot. And I think it's an important point to make to first responders is it's your responsibility to stay fit. But also you got to think yourself, in the same way that law enforcement does, and being able to protect yourself is important as well, because some of these people, I still, to this day, I work in a very safe area now in Disney. I still stand to the side of the door when I knock, because you never know, you know, you never know. So I'm intrigued. I really don't hear a lot of those cases in the legal field. And I think that's maybe something that we should report more, you know, if
no,
people
a good
are getting
point.
Hurt.
Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah.
Okay. And then, so the very last thing, this is a weird question because of the building I'm sitting in, but coming from the UK, when I first came here about 15 years ago, I remember clearly looking at Yellow Pages, I guess it was in a hotel, and seeing this thick band on the side where the pages were, and I assumed it was doctors or, you know, something, and it was attorneys. Now, obviously, I can say this to you because you know, have an amazing road that you're on, and you're truly protecting people. So it seems to me, though, in the role of the firefighter, policeman, EMS, and in life in general, that we have a real issue with frivolous lawsuits as well.
Yeah.
So being an attorney yourself and talking about paradigm shifts, is there anything in the legal world you think that's going to stop this thing where people are able to sue because their coffee was too hot and it spilled on them, or all these crazy stories that we hear about? You know, is there a shift away from these super frivolous where the, you know, the ambulance chasers are following and you get hit 3 miles an hour, next thing you're asking to be backboarded because you think you're going to be disabled the rest of your life?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a very good question. And I work for one of the biggest personal injury law firms in the world, quite frankly. And the reason I did it was because I had gotten calls for years about people who had different types of injuries, but who trusted me as an honest guy to help them with their claim. And I met with John Morgan, and he just wanted to extend his reach and scope of practice to first responders that he might not have been able to reach. And I know the folks at this firm. I know a lot of the lawyers. I know John. These are good people, and they're not the so-called ambulance chasers that they might be seemed as, because John is always, you know, in an advertisement or always on TV and you hear about him all the time. He's a great guy, and he's not out to pursue cases for the sake of money. There are enough cases out there with legitimate basis for recovery. I'm more sort of angry at insurance companies who summarily deny cases for legitimate injuries. And I think that's John's motivation too, despite the net result that a lot of money comes from these things. But John doesn't take a dime from anybody. He won't take anything where it requires somebody to walk into the door and put money down on the table to hire him. He just doesn't do that. He fronts so much money in litigating cases, valid, legitimate cases where people are clearly hurt and suffer in a lot of cases very, very serious injuries. And so this whole idea of this so-called ambulance chaser, I don't think it applies to John Morgan at all. I can say that without hesitation. He's a very decent guy, and he takes cases that are legitimate. But I think the point is there are so many legitimate cases out there where people just can't find good counsel because the insurance companies have just endless dollars to defend these things into the ground. And so I'm very proud to be here as a part of this team, and I extend any type of case. In fact, I'll even back up a little bit. When I came here a few years ago, it's either 2 years or 3 years come June. I think it's 3 years now, where we have been able to help first responders with VA benefits, with Social Security disability, with auto accident cases, with medical malpractice, legitimate stuff, really, really legitimate stuff. And I could not be prouder to extend the reach to those folks in all of these different areas of the law for people who trust me to help them with these cases. And I work with the lawyers in this firm to handle those types of cases, and really proud of it.
Right. So where do you think the mentality that we see a lot in the streets of a 2 mile an hour fender bender, I'm going to be a millionaire now mentality comes from?
I don't see that mentality, but I guess I don't buy into the premise. I mean, I think, and I'm not a PI guy. I handle with other lawyers some cases, but this sort of fender bender that shouldn't be able to result in injury, I think, is flawed. First of all, I mean, the transfer of energy through the body of a car, even though it's not a massive T-bone that you and I would extricate someone from, doesn't mean that they don't suffer significant whiplash and resulting injury. I think they do in some cases, and that's for the PI guys to handle. But I think in every sort of area you're going to have bad apples, and to give the profession a bad name, I don't think the fire department's immune from that either. But in terms of this so-called ambulance chasing, you're going to get bad apples. But I'll tell you, this firm is solid and it's legitimate. And the attorneys I know here, including John Morgan, are just fantastic people and do the right thing for the right reason.
Okay, brilliant. I mean, it's I don't get to sit in front of an attorney very often, and it's one of those things from the field. And I'm sure there's a lot of heads nodding right now. You know, you see where the dirt on the number plate's barely been moved. I remember Hialeah years and years and years ago, a guy was just backing out of a parking space. I mean, he was probably doing 2 miles an hour. And then he was laid out like, it was the end of the world.
I would dare say that a case like that would yield about as much as that person was legitimately injured. So that case that you explain where they're laid out on a backboard and then demand to be, fully strapped down to a board and go into a hospital are not going to be those so-called millionaires that you think are going to be chasing dollars. Those are the folks who are going to get exactly what, their injury results in.
Yeah.
But we see, and I've seen come through my door, first responders and their families be involved in very serious accidents, and this firm has been a tremendous help to them.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. I mean, because that's my exact point when we're talking about the spectrum politically, left and right, that's where the abuse is, and then every frivolous case where they're detracting legal money and a lot of times, government money too, is taken away from the people that we see a lot in our profession that truly are hurt.
That's right.
And we can't always, don't get me wrong, we can't always see how hurt someone is from the damage in the car. But we've all seen there's a certain number that's always on the radio, that's always advertising the moment you after 911, you call another number. There's certainly an encouragement of a certain action and it seems like an implying of the fact that if anything's happened at all, that there's going to be a check coming your way. And I think that detracts from your profession, and it certainly makes our profession harder because, it extends a scene time a huge amount. If someone doesn't have an injury, but they're thinking about this could lead to something else. That's kind of the point.
See the point. Yeah, certainly.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So I always wrap up the interviews with a few short questions. So the first one would be, is there a book that you would recommend to people?
Oh, boy. I haven't had the luxury of being able to sit down and read a book. I am a huge Ernest Hemingway fan. I'm a huge Hemingway buff. And years ago, I would read a lot of his books. So any one of his books are right up my alley. Okay. Yeah.
Brilliant. And then what about a movie and or a documentary?
A movie. Gosh, since I have young kids, I think most of my movies are related to kids. I wouldn't recommend any of them as an adult. I want to see this movie called The Lion. I'm a huge Howard Stern fan, and he was on about a month ago really championing this.
Is it called The Lion or Lion?
Lion.
It's amazing. I watched it the
other day. Seen it?
Yeah. I'll recommend it back to you then.
Okay. That's what I want to see. It's if that incredible. Even comes close to answering your question.
Yes.
That's on my list.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right. Because I did a post the other day. I always ask people to recommend a movie, but I'm going to recommend one myself today.
Well, if you'll have me back and you ask me the same question, assuming it's good, I'll recommend that one. I hear a lot of good things about it. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. We'll definitely do a part two because I'm sure... a certain amount of time down the road, maybe we'll have some more information on some of the things that you've got so close with this time. So that'd be great to revisit everything.
Yeah.
All right. Now, this is a great question for you. When you want to decompress, when you get to step away from the desk, what do you like to do?
Watch my son play basketball.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what you were doing when we texted last
time. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. He's 10 years old and he plays AAU ball. And I don't get any better enjoyment in anything in life than watching him play. and my daughter, who's 13, she's not a sports person. She's my academic. But she and I sitting in the stands watching him play, there is nothing better in my life than that.
Brilliant.
That's it.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, I've got a 9-year old who does jiu-jitsu, and I love watching him roll.
Yeah.
That's what I was doing right before here.
So fun.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. And then a very important one now, because we've talked about several things. So where can people find you? And then also, where can they find about the Cardiac Scan Initiative and some of the other things that we've talked about?
You can find me at MikeClellandLaw.com. It's all one. It's Mike, and then my last name is spelled C-L-E-L-L-A-N-D, law.com. My direct number is 407-629-8300. And I always give out my cell phone number, and it's 407-375-8887. And I'll elaborate on that just a little bit. When I was in law school, I had this idea that, you know, not a lot of people like lawyers. And one of the reasons they don't is because they're not responsive. And so I made it a goal of mine that when I started practicing law, I would make myself available. So anyone who can't reach me through my direct line, one of my assistants might be on the other phone and it might go to voicemail, they can call my cell phone, they can text me, and if I'm in the middle of a basketball game with my son, it won't mean that I'll answer you, but if you leave me a message, I promise I will respond to you. If there's anything in my 10 years of practicing law that people say about me, it's that I get back to them. I mean, I'm always back with somebody within a few hours, at the max 24 hours, I'll get a response to them. Might not be able to help them. I might be able to provide some help. Might text them back and say, hey, give me 5 minutes or give me an hour or two or whatever. Nights, weekends, it doesn't matter. You can call me or text me.
Okay. I think that's an art that we've lost as a society, you know, responding to phone calls and texts.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. You know. But I'm happy to do it. And my email is mcclelland@forthepeople.com.
Okay. And then the cardiac bill, is there anywhere to go as of now to find information on that?
Yes. It's 112.18 of the Florida statutes. But it's, you know, the legislation, the statute itself is only a paragraph thick, but the case law interpreting it is volumes and volumes thick. So I would just ask people that if they have any question about the heart-lung presumption, whether they qualify, whether pre-employment physical, whether it's disability, whether they have heart disease, what form of heart disease, please just call me. I'll walk you through it. You don't have to hire me, and there's no charge to hire me. I'll be happy to walk you through it. I want you to get the benefit that you deserve. And if it means, you know, how do I notify my employer? Did I notify them timely? Did I notify the right person? They denied my case. They denied it under 120-day provision. All these sort of questions are always flying out there. If they need those answers, just call me. Call my direct line or call myself.
Okay. And then what about the cardiac scan initiative you're doing with the hospital?
Yeah, I would like for those who are listening to go to their local or their department, find out who would be interested, how many. Let's say there's a 100-man department or 100 guys and gals on the department. If you broach the idea and say, hey, how many of you would go through a free calcium score scan if a hospital chain offered it? You know, just shoot me an idea. Shoot me an email or a text saying, hey, Mike, I'm from wherever. And I got 50 guys who would go through it tomorrow. Just, I need some idea. And I'm going to be making this presentation at the FPF conference next week in Sarasota, and then to the FOP after that, and then Miami-Dade. So I'm going to get a better understanding of how many folks would be coming in the door if I can line this up with the hospital chains. And so I think your listeners get the point. If they know about how many in their department would undergo this free or very, very inexpensive scan, that'd be helpful. Either email me or give me a call.
Awesome. Yeah, I think there's a lot of local guys that listen to this. So hopefully if we can get one per department to try and rally around, then
yeah,
hopefully we'll get maybe a lot
point
of emails.
Person. Yeah, yeah, good.
Beautiful. All right. Well, I think that's it. So thank you so much for talking to everyone, because I know I have my head in my rear end a lot of times when it comes to these kind of issues. And actually, you know, like you said as well, I had a very bad experience with actually the last two really on the legal side have not gone well. And we've talked about the most recent one. Obviously you don't want to tar everyone with the same brush. So I'm glad that we were able to highlight, you know, yourself and Morgan & Morgan as a company and remove you from some of you know, the negative views of law and see that there's people like yourself that are championing, you know, our profession and really fighting to make things better for us. So thank you so much.
I appreciate you having me. I enjoyed it, and I'll do it again. Thank you. Thank you.